Welcome. This is Michael Munger, Director of Duke University's Philosophy, Politics, and Economics program. This lecture series is produced by the PPE program, and all the material in these lectures is the property of the PPE program. You are free to use these recordings for any educational purpose, so long as you give proper credit to Duke University and to the individual speakers in each lecture. The lecture series is sponsored by Duke University and by a generous donation from the Thomas W. Smith Foundation. If you have questions about the series or about the PPE program, please contact me, Michael Munger, at munger@duke.edu. And now, enjoy today's lecture. Well, welcome. It is a pleasure to introduce this morning Professor Kevin Greer from the University of Oklahoma, who is going to give us a talk about monetary policy and one of the most important economic analysts of our time, John Stuart.
Throughout the financial crisis, that's right, we're still talking about it. Our economy has been guided by the Federal Reserve Bank, which is now engaged in a $1 trillion+ program to prop up the economy called quantitative easing. It's not a made-up phrase, if that's what you're thinking. It's when the Fed buys up government debt with money that they make out of thin air. Sounds like they're printing money. Nuh-uh.
One myth that's out there is that what we're doing is printing money. We're not printing money.
See? As Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, we're not printing money, we're imagineering money. Printing money would be like last year when we were making things quantitatively easier for banks by buying up massive amounts of their debt using money created from thin air. That was printing money. Don't take my word for it. Take the guy with the exact same beard on the exact same show talking to the exact same interviewer not 21 months ago.
To lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account that they have with the Fed. So it's much more akin, although not exactly the same, but it's much more akin to printing money than it is to borrowing.
You have printed money?
Well, effectively, and we need to do that.
What? I guess Bernanke was looking at the average age of a 60 Minutes viewer and betting anyone who saw him last year is dead now. Just admit it, Bernanke, you're a guy with a beard who's allowed to print money. Which makes you look smarter and more powerful than people who can't print money and don't have beards. Frankly, I tried growing a beard, and my power, if anything, diminished. It's the ability to print money, that's the thing. So go ahead then, print money. Aside from Zimbabwe-like hyperinflation, what could go wrong?
A printing problem has forced the government to put more than 1 billion brand new $100 bills into storage. Production has been halted until a fix is figured out.
Are you f***ing me? Now we can't even print money? That was the last thing we were good at.
Process, which incorporates high-tech features like 3D security strips, color-shifting images, is so complex that it's causing bills to crease and fold during production.
We've outsmarted ourselves with our own fancy security measures to the point where our money is committing suicide on the press. I hope we still remember our passwords, or at least the answers to the security question prompts. Ooh, what's our country's maiden name? Great Britain, I believe. So apparently the only way to fix the economy is to print money, but we can't print money. The only way the story could get worse is if it somehow also added to global warming.
It will take more than a year to sift through those piles of cash and find the bad bills, which will be taken out and burned.
Outdoor fires in front of homeless people.
So besides the obvious poetic license that John Stuart was taking there, it's the Fed doesn't actually print the bills, right? That's the Treasury's job. So when Bernanke says or doesn't say, depending on which time he's interviewed, that the Fed is printing money or not printing money, he means that they're buying things from banks by simply creating a credit, an electronic credit on the bank's account. And what the Fed actually controls are reserves, bank reserves, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But let me try to be a little bit more organized than just jumping in and trying to follow up John Stewart. My name is Kevin Greer. Mike, thanks for having me. Happy to talk to you guys. Prospective students in the audience, extra pressure. Don't want to mess things up for Duke here. Oklahoma has a great political economy program, if you might want to consider that. Here's the outline of what I'm going to talk about today. Just some basic stuff about what is the Fed, how is it structured, how does it work, how is it supposed to work, and what's it been doing, and how do we think of what kind of job we expect to do. I don't know how much background you guys have on this topic, so if this is too elementary, let me know. We can talk about something else. We can go faster, go slower, whatever you would like. So please feel free to give me any feedback that you might think is relevant. So the Fed is a very odd creation. It's sort of unique amongst central banks around the world, and it has a very weird, unwieldy structure. And part of the reason for that is that central banking in the United States was viewed with suspicion. It was viewed as a way for rich East Coast urban type people in the 1700s and 1800s to put the hammer down on poor rural farming Western people. So we had tried to have a national bank. We tried to have a second national bank. They were chartered. When their charters expired, they were not renewed. And the U.S. didn't really have a central bank. In the interim, we kept having problems with the banking system. The banking panic of 1907, sort of a mini Great Depression, bank runs, can't get your money, credit shut down, finally got Congress going to try to reestablish a central bank in the United States. But rather than just making one centralized institution, they decided to try to make it easier to swallow for people around the country by making it have a regional component. So there's a centralized part, the Board of Governors, which sits in Washington, D.C., has 7 members. Ben Bernanke is the chairman of the Board of Governors. He's a member of the Board of Governors. They're appointed by the president, approved by the Senate. And then there are these regional banks. There's 12 separate banks in cities across the country, as you can see them listed here. And the monetary policy making part of the Fed is a mixture of these two groups. The Federal Open Market Committee, which is the committee that makes the announcements about the Fed is going to do this or the Fed is going to do that. The 7 members of the Board of Governors and 5 of the presidents of the 12 reserve banks sit on the Federal Open Market Committee. The bank president, the president of the New York Fed, is always on the committee, and then the other guys rotate around and take turns. So these are the people that vote on monetary policy. Presidents of the reserve banks don't necessarily have to be economists. Some of them are business people. The president of the Dallas Fed used to be the chairman of Alcoa Aluminum Company. So you get a wide mix of people who are on these presidents of these banks. Okay. This is a really crappy picture. I apologize for that. These are the boundaries of the districts. You guys in Duke here, you're in the 5th district. Your bank is in Richmond, Virginia. I live way out here in the 10th district in Oklahoma. Our bank is in Kansas City. And you can see there's sort of this geographic spread. But over time, especially since World War II, the power of the Fed of monetary policy is concentrated in Washington. What's the Fed supposed to do? They're created by Congress. The Constitution gives Congress the right to coin money and regulate the currency. Congress has delegated that responsibility to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 gave the Fed unbelievably vague instructions about what they should do: furnish an elastic currency. Mm-hmm. Obviously not meant literally. It would be one of the big problems with the money supply in the early 1900s was that it was very seasonal. There would be easy credit in some parts of the year, and especially when farmers needed to borrow and things like that in the wintertime, there would be very tight credit. So the seasonality of the credit cycle was something that people wanted addressed. In 1977, the Federal Reserve Act was amended, and it was amended just to put like an impossible burden on the Fed. So to increase production to promote effectively the goal of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Utopia. Right. So the Fed's responsible for everything. This was way too vague, and this is just unbelievably utopian. Congress has always sort of treated the Fed as if it was independent, but the Fed is a creation of Congress. Their legislative acts can change the Fed's mandate at any time. Members of the Board of Governors are appointed by the President. They're confirmed by the Congress. So there's a lot of congressional oversight of the Fed. even though it's very convenient for Congress people to portray the Fed as, and it's not us, Congress, that's raising your interest rates, it's just this independent body that we have very little influence over, the Fed, that's doing these terrible things to the economy. So it's a very convenient setup in that regard. How does the Fed do this? What does the Fed do when they conduct monetary policy? A famous economist, Alan Blinder from Princeton University, described the process of monetary policy making as enlightened discretion. That is, there's no rule that fixes or constrains what the Fed does with policy. They can do pretty much whatever they want, unless they get Congress so angry that they will intervene legislatively. And so the policy, if we think of one thing on one side being a rule, on the other side of that we would have discretion, meaning the policymakers can sort of do what they want. Enlightened meaning that Alan Blinder thinks they do a pretty good job, so he calls it enlightened discretion. Questions so far? It's a little early for complaints. Complaints so far? No? Okay. So the way that this policy process works, we don't know how the Fed comes to the decision that they come to, and they don't have to tell us, but the way that the process works is that the economic staff at the Board of Governors does tons of research. The Fed and the Board of Governors and the branch banks are the biggest employer of economists in the United States. Each Federal Reserve Bank has a whole staff of economists that do research, write reports, publish papers. The Board of Governors has several different groups, research groups, that all hire PhD economists. So it's great for us, right? There's a lot of work there. But the economic staff makes reports about economic conditions and forecasts. They take those reports to the Open Market Committee. Those 12 people that vote, they then sit around the room like this, they talk things over, they take a vote, and then they announce what the policy is going to be. Right now in the United States, the policy announcement that they give, generally speaking, is they announce a value for a particular interest rate. And the interest rate that they target is called the Fed funds rate. The Fed funds rate is the interest rate that's charged in the market where banks lend reserve to each other on very short-term basis, like overnight. Up until very recently, the Federal Reserve didn't pay interest on bank reserves. Now they pay a very small amount of interest. That's something that they just started to do. So banks are required to hold reserves as against the liabilities that they have, right? So that if you come to a bank and want to withdraw a bunch of money, they have to have sufficient reserves to deal with planned withdrawals and things like that. There's a regulation amount of reserves that they have to hold. Over and above that, they will hold reserves temporarily, and they'll want, though, to take that money and loan it out, right, to make money. Okay? So the Fed tries to influence this target rate that banks lend reserves to each other. Some bank might have a greater than anticipated amount of withdrawals. Their reserves are getting down close to the legal limit. Another bank might have had less risk withdrawals than they thought. They have extra reserves. So they loan them back and forth to each other in this federal funds market. Very short term, just like overnight. And so it's that interest rate, the Fed funds rate, or that the Federal Reserve announces, okay, our target for the next 3 months for the federal funds rate is, right now it's 0.75%. And so it's very low right now. Yes?
So the federal funds rate is only among the banks?
It's between banks. That's correct.
So it's surprising that it's such an important target, it's such an important bellwether.
The idea is that this is sort of a short-term interbank rate, and the idea is as that rate goes down, right, that banks will start lending out an increasing supply of loans, okay, and that will push other market rates down as well, like commercial paper rates or mortgage rates or things like that. But it's definitely the case that, except for what John Stewart was making fun of Ben Bernanke for here, and we'll talk about towards the end of the talk, this quantitative easing program, the Fed's monetary policy operates in the very shortest end of the market, right? It's an interest rate on overnight money. Even though the things that probably the Fed cares about are much longer-term interest rates, mortgage interest rates, what are the interest rates people have to borrow on credit cards to buy consumer durables and things like that. How does it work? Well, the Fed uses, as Bernanke was saying, they use printing money, right? They increase the quantity of reserves in the banking system, then buy some asset from a bank, like a government bond or a mortgage or something like that. They'll take that asset, put it on their books as something that they now own, and they will pay for it at the bank by simply increasing the bank's credit account at the Fed. So they don't create money as in printing new currency, dollar bills or things like that. But they do create reserves, and reserves feed into the money supply almost directly. The way this theory is supposed to work is open market operations are targeted to affect interest rates. Changes in interest rates are targeted to affect the economy. What part of the economy? Well, it depends, right? The Fed's supposed to have maximum employment and stable prices. That's right. So the legislative goal for the Fed is what? Maximum employment. Hard to see what that is. Let's say 3% unemployment, maybe, something like that. When do you think a congressperson would announce to his constituents that he or she was satisfied with the rate of unemployment? Or even say, where they would say, oh, the Fed's done a perfect job, unemployment is right where it should be. As long as there's one unemployed voter in their district, they're highly unlikely to ever say something like that, right? Unemployment could always get lower. But at the same time, we don't want any inflation. So the Fed chooses essentially what it is they're fighting at the time, and they decide to raise and lower interest rates. They would lower interest rates if they want to try to expand economic activity, and they would raise interest rates if they were trying to fight against inflation. And since the 1990s, this is the way the Fed has officially conducted policy. They've announced a target rate that they want the federal funds rate to trade at, and they've intervened in the market with open market operations, buying and selling of financial assets, raising and lowering the amount of reserves in the banking system, so that banks will lend reserves to each other at something very near that target rate. Okay. In the past, in the 1970s and 1980s, and if you remember back to the definition, to maintain long-run growth of monetary aggregates, right? Not interest rates. It wasn't listed as there. Interest rate was an outcome, but not listed as sort of a target variable. In the past, in the 70s and 80s, the Fed would announce a growth rate target for the money supply rather than a target for the interest rate. And they would work. They only have one bullet. The Fed essentially only has one bullet. They can print money. They can create reserves and take reserves in and out of the banking system. So they could use that ability to manipulate reserves to affect, say, the quantity of money in circulation. They could use that ability to manipulate reserves to affect a particular market interest rate. But aside from like regulatory activity, that's pretty much all the Fed can do in the monetary policy world, is affect the amount of the total amount of bank reserves. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, has the Fed done a good job or not? Okay. We have a long time to cover. The Fed went into business in 1913. It's now 2011. And I don't know how many of you guys know this, right? There's quite a big anti-Fed movement in the United States today. There's a congressman who runs for president or threatens to run for president a lot named Ron Paul from Texas, my neighbor state of Texas, who's not a big fan of the Fed. There are a lot of libertarian economists who are very anti-Fed. We'll talk a little bit about their point of view at the end if we have time to do that. So let's just talk briefly about Fed performance. I want to break it down into different chunks of history. Fed started in 1913 and was working, and we'll look at the period from 1913 to World War II. We'll take World War II out of the equation since things there were driven by trying to win the war. On the plus side of Fed policy in that time period, the seasonality of the money supply that we talked about earlier, that was greatly reduced. Jeff Miron, you know him, the guy from Harvard, he wrote a very influential paper in the American Economic Review showing that the founding of the Fed greatly reduced the seasonality of credit supplies in the money supply. However, there's a gigantic minus for the Fed's account before World War II, and that is the Great Depression. The stock market crash of 1929, unemployment rates of about 30%, unemployment rates above 15% for 5 or 6 years in a row. Instead of inflation, the economic problem that was going on was deflation. Prices were falling rather than rising at rates of 8 to 10% a year for years during the Depression. Pretty much the worst economic times that the United States has ever had. There's been a huge debate in the economics profession about how much the Fed was to blame for this. The current chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, is one of the preeminent monetary historians and students of monetary policy. He's an excellent choice in that regard to be the Fed chair during the financial crisis because he's a student of the Great Depression. He claimed in a public speech 4 or 5 years ago that, yes, the Fed was responsible for the Great Depression, but they had learned their lesson from that, and they would not make the same mistakes if they made them. So in my accounting, at least, we're going to chalk up this period, the beginning of the Fed, as a big failure. In that, they presided over and helped to cause and helped to prolong the worst economic conditions that had ever happened in the United States, even back from the 1700s, before there were central banks, before there was even government currency.
And it appears that Ben Bernanke agrees with you.
Yes. Yes. That view, like I said, that view has been debated among economists. Milton Friedman, the famous monetarist economist, was a very strong critic of the Fed. And it was actually at a speech that Bernanke gave at a party to celebrate Milton Friedman's 95th birthday, where Bernanke got up in front of the crowd and said, "Milton Friedman, you're right. The Depression was the Fed's fault." He apologized on the part of the Fed. He said, "We're sorry. We screwed up back then. But we've learned our lesson, and something like that will never happen again." Okay? And we'll talk about how the Fed responded in the current crisis differently from the first crisis, from the Great Depression. After World War II, the international monetary system was organized according to what's often called the Bretton Woods system. The United States was the dominant economy after the war. Everybody announced, most countries, free market countries, announced an exchange rate that was fixed to the U.S. The U.S. dollar was fixed to gold at $35 an ounce. So there was a worldwide system of fixed exchange rates anchored on gold, but it was actually the U.S. dollar that served as reserves of other countries. So the U.S. held gold reserves, other countries held dollar reserves. And you could, at the time, literally at the time, citizens could take their dollar bills to the Treasury and convert it into gold. As time went on, and the Fed's policy got less and less consistent with having gold be $35 an ounce, the government made it harder and harder and harder for people to actually convert their bills into gold. And when other countries were concerned that the Fed wouldn't be able, the Treasury wouldn't be able to redeem bills into gold, that's when in 1971 and 1972, when Richard Nixon was president, the Bretton Woods system collapsed. And the fixed exchange rate system went out the window, the dollars linked to gold was terminated in the early 1970s. And that was sort of a part one of the birth of the modern Fed. When you're in a fixed exchange rate system, when you're tied to the gold standard, the central bank doesn't have very much discretion or very much power to choose whatever policy they want to choose. Okay? They can't create a lot of inflation, because if they print up tons and tons of dollars, those dollars are redeemable for gold at a fixed price, and they could print up more money than the Treasury had gold to redeem the money, and that would be a serious problem. That actually happened in the early 1960s, right, where the Fed had printed up where foreign countries held more dollar reserves than we had gold in Fort Knox to convert it into gold on demand. So the late part of the Bretton Woods was simply the U.S. making it harder and harder and harder for people to actually convert dollars into gold. And finally, Germany was the country that just said, we're not doing this anymore. You know, we want our gold now. And we said, okay, forget it. No more converting the dollar into gold at that point. So the Fed, what I'm trying to say really is the Fed wasn't, they didn't really stick fully to the rules of the game during this time period, but there really isn't much to really evaluate the Fed on, because this sort of pseudo gold standard was sort of the dominant thing that was going on. The Fed was a little more secondary at that point. The modern Fed, so it would start from that point of time, okay, where the Fed now doesn't have a gold standard to constrain it. It can do whatever it wants, subject to congressional oversight in terms of the supply of credit, the supply of money. It's also in the 1970s, right? We know in 77 where the Federal Reserve Act was amended, giving the Fed much more responsibility over economic outcomes. Okay, so the Fed both gets explicitly a much harder job, okay, maximum employment and stable prices, and much more discretion, much more ability to act how they think they should act in order to bring those goals about. We know, at least those of us who talk to our parents, and our parents can tell us about the bad days in the 1970s and early 1980s, where we had high inflation, 10%, 12%, 13%, high unemployment rates, 9%, 10%, 11% for years in a row. So we know that the Fed did not do a good job of controlling inflation, and the fact that they allowed there to be high inflation didn't help economic performance to be very strong either in the 1970s and early 1980s. A couple things happened in the early 1980s. One, Ronald Reagan was elected president. We went from a relatively liberal president to a relatively conservative president. also the United States Senate, the power of party majority in the Senate switch from relatively liberal Democrats to a majority that was led by relatively conservative Republicans. It was also the case that the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve changed at that time. Very famous man, Paul Volcker, became chairman of the Fed in 1979. And in the early 80s, the combination of sort of Volcker's bureaucratic drive and a conservative government caused the Fed to have the backbone or the political cover or the ability to lower inflation sharply by raising interest rates to a very high level to reduce inflation. We ended up with a very deep recession in 81 and 82. But out of that, we got low inflation, relatively good economic performance, and this period before the financial crisis in the late 1980s and 1990s and into the early 2000s is a period that macroeconomists refer to as the Great Moderation. Inflation was low, inflation was stable, unemployment was low, output growth was stable, and as we've done several times in the past, economists declared victory. Right? We figured this out, we know how it works, we've learned our lessons, we've got things under control, and everything's going to be sort of unicorns and rainbows from here on out. And we know, sadly now, we know that that didn't turn out to be the case. Okay? We know that really bad things happened in 2006 and 2007, and we're still dealing with the consequences of those now. Questions or comments about the sort of historical type of material that we covered?
Why did we have inflation in the first place, like, in the 1970s?
Okay, so that's a very good question. Why did we end up with such high inflation in the 1970s? From since World War II, right, we hadn't seen inflation anything like that at all. One reason I would give was that the Bretton Woods system sort of, in some sense, insulated the Fed prevented the Fed from figuring out how their policies would actually work. You know, it sort of kept them in this gold standard box, and they didn't really get a lot of experience doing independent monetary policy. So even though the Fed had been around since 1913, they kind of were new to what they were supposed to be doing. Okay. We had, in the early 1970s, was when the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, first got together, first formed a cartel, jacked up oil prices. And the Federal Reserve's response to this increase in oil prices, which is just a relative price, a single price, was to increase the quantity of money, increase the rate of growth of credit, right? And rather than causing the economy to overcome the negative effects of the oil shock, what that increase in money and credit did was raise the overall level of prices and create inflation. There's a very old and hotly debated economic theory called the Phillips curve. Are you guys heard of this or familiar with this at all? There was a belief that there was a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. In the 1950s, some British economists graphed data on the rate of change of prices and the rate of change of unemployment in Britain, and they found if we put inflation here and unemployment here, they found sort of a non-linear relationship like this. And here are the data points, and here's the curve that they fit to it. The sort of Keynesian macroeconomics of the 1960s and 1970s came to believe that this was some sort of relationship that could be manipulated for policy purposes. They came to believe that that historical curve was like a menu, okay? And you could pick where you wanted to be. Right, so if you wanted lower unemployment, fine, that's fine. We can do that if that's what you want, but we're going to have to take some higher inflation as the cost. So the estimated curve was viewed by a lot of people in the 60s and in the 1970s as a fixed, stable, immutable relationship that we could pick where we wanted to operate on. It turned out, economists not being the brightest of all the scientists in the world, it turned out that was just some historical correlation. And it wasn't some immutable law of nature. And when monetary policy tried to raise inflation deliberately to reduce unemployment, right, they wanted to reduce the unemployment that was coming from this big increase in oil prices. The United States was an oil importer. Higher oil prices meant much higher costs of doing business. much less ability to sell products, decline in demand for labor, higher unemployment and things like that, negative economic consequences. The Fed tried to deal with that by monetary easing, thinking they could move along the Phillips curve and maintain a decent level of unemployment at the cost of some inflation. When it didn't work that well, they just decided to double down and try to ease monetary policy even more, ending up with even higher inflation. And then what we see the Phillips curve data points start to look like now, right, is just a big mess. Okay? So economists have a lot in the world to apologize for. That would certainly be one of the things, believing that that was a relationship that policymakers could just pick and choose points on. Turned out that once you actually tried to use that as some sort of fixed rule, that it disappeared. I think that's a fairly balanced answer to the question of why do we need so much inflation. And getting rid of inflation then, if you believe in this relationship, even though it might have been semi-falsified by not reducing unemployment, getting rid of inflation would be really risky, right? Because this says the only way to get a lower inflation is to accept higher unemployment. And so we've got this high inflation, it didn't really do what our theory said it would do, reduce unemployment, but we're really afraid to get rid of it because our theory is still telling us if we reduce inflation, that will get another big increase in unemployment as well.
So it is pretty hard to be the Fed. It's hard for them to reduce unemployment, but they can increase it.
Yeah, I would go for that. Yeah.
So that it's easy for them to screw things up.
It's easy for them to screw things up if they try to live up to the mandate that Congress gave them in the 1970s, maximum employment and stable prices. For one, I mean, one basic tenet of economics, or even of math, just of control theory, right, is if you have two targets that are independent of each other, but you only have one policy instrument to use, you can't ever hit two independent targets with one. Right, just think about if there's two, dare I say, criminals running around and you only have one bullet, right, unless they line up with each other and move directly with each other, you can never hit both of them. Right, so the Fed is never going to be able to live up to their mandate of maximum employment and stable prices, because those things don't move in perfect correlation, and they only have one thing that they can do, control reserves. So the mandate of the Fed puts them in a bad position. Congressional pressure, when unemployment is high, there's pressure to ease. When inflation is high, there's pressure to fight inflation. And so a lot of what they do ends up being reacting to political pressure, even though the claim is that the Fed is independent. So yeah, the Fed can get into a lot of trouble when they try to do more things than they can actually do. I agree with that. Okay. So this is a sadly very hard to read graph. This is the U.S. annual inflation rate in the U.S. from 1900 to 2005 or 6. There's this huge burst of inflation in the 19-teens after the creation of the Fed. A decline, this is 1929 here, this is the deflation of the Great Depression. You can see that the rate of inflation reached negative 10% here, which is pretty unprecedented. This is World War II. This is the high inflation of the 1970s and early 1980s. You can see there's two peaks here, the first oil shock in the early 70s, the second oil shock in the late 70s. This giant decline right here is after the election of the Republicans, after Paul Volcker becomes Fed chair, and there's political backing to say, we have to get inflation under control, that's first and foremost what we need to do, we have here, and then this is the period of the Great Moderation, where inflation, you can see how volatile inflation is here, how much it's moving up and down and bouncing around, and how smooth it is here. If we had a graph of output growth, of GDP growth, we would sort of see the same thing, that the volatility of GDP growth slowed down quite a bit in this era. Most economists now believe that was just due to good luck. The external shocks that hit the economy were very benign and favorable, and that it isn't necessarily due to increased skill on the part of our policymakers. Even though the policymakers, obviously, you're going to claim credit for good. You get blamed for the bad times, so you may as well claim credit for the good times. Okay. So here's a good question. Did the Fed cause the 2007 crisis? You can see my answer there. I wouldn't say cause. That's a big. I wouldn't say really that you could say there's any one thing that caused the crisis. But I believe that the Fed did contribute to the crisis in that it created very loose monetary policy, very much a large expansion of credit, extra low interest rates. And it's historically, we know that credit expansions and excess credit are often the preconditions for building up asset price bubbles. The explosion in the early 2000s up to 2005 and 2006, the huge increase in the rate of growth of house prices, we would consider that a classic asset bubble, right? Prices were rising faster than the fundamental economic value of the asset, and they were rising that way because people just expected they would keep going up and they could resell later at a profit. So it's just a classic case of an asset bubble that burst and caused, and that was the financial crisis. I'm going to argue that the Fed contributed to this by overly loose monetary policy. And I'm going to take a minute here. When do we stop?
9:40.
Okay. I think I can finish. Awesome. I'm going to take a minute here to explain how economists evaluate what the Fed does. So a very famous economist, John Taylor, created a policy rule to say what should the Fed set the federal funds rate at? What's the correct target for the Fed to pick for the federal funds rate? In most macroeconomic, mathematical macroeconomic models, like if you go across the quad here in the econ department, go and look at the models that they're using, they will use a Taylor rule as a rule to describe actual monetary policy. Although the Fed doesn't actually, has never committed to using it, and as we'll see, deviates from it a lot. The Taylor rule says the Fed should, if there was no inflation and no output gap, if output was at full employment and inflation was zero, the optimal interest rate would be 2%. If inflation rises, the interest rate should rise by 1.5 times the rise in inflation. And if the output gap rises, if output falls below full employment, if output rises above full employment, I'm sorry, the Fed should raise interest rates as well.
And in principle, if there were deflation, then?
Well, it's a real problem with this because if there's deflation, rates should go down. But what do we know about interest rates? What's the lowest interest rate there could possibly be?
Zero,
right. So we can't have a negative interest rate, and that's a real problem for the Fed, has been a real problem for the Fed for the last 2 or 3 years. Economists call that problem the zero-bound problem. So I'm going to show you a stylized picture of, this is the actual setting of the federal funds rate. You can see the years here. These are the years leading up to the crisis. This is a smoothed-out version of what the Taylor rule said the interest rate should have been set at. So the argument that economists make is that the Fed, after 9/11 and after the tech stock boom in bust in 2000, that the Fed artificially kept interest rates much lower than economic conditions call for them to be. And these too low or artificially low or overly low interest rates led to expansion of reserves and expansion of credit. Interest rates are low, so people are looking for a place to put their money to get a rate of return. Subprime mortgages turned out to be the place that a lot of people decided to put their money. Okay. So monetary policy was too loose before the crisis. Credit expansions could often fuel asset bubbles. And so the argument is that the Fed bears some responsibility for the starting of the housing price bubble due to this overly loose monetary policy. I don't know if I would call this a defense of the Fed, but we can at least say they weren't the only ones to do this. This is the European Central Bank, the bank that's charged with monetary policy for the euro area. The blue line is, and these are not smooth, that's why they're jump here, because I took these from two different sources. The blue line is the interest rate setting from Taylor's rule, the optimal interest rate setting, or the correct one, given economic conditions. The yellow line is the interest rate that the European Central Bank set. And you can see the same thing from 2000. And so there's a overly low interest rates, overly loose monetary policy, large amount of credit expansion. So in both of these cases, probably the two most important central banks in the world, the argument is their policies were too loose, created this asset, this credit expansion, helped to fuel the asset price. I could come back and give another talk about what did cause the financial crisis, which is a fascinating topic. But from here, this is sort of, I think, monetary policy's role on the bad side was being overly loose in the early periods and helping to get the housing bubble going. So I'll come back to should we abolish the Fed, and let's talk a little bit about what's the Fed's... this is what I wanted to do. Let's talk about the plus side of the Fed in the crisis. Did the Fed save us from catastrophe? Remember I told you that Ben Bernanke was a student of the Great Depression, a student of monetary history, and he promised Milton Friedman on his 95th birthday that the Fed would never let anything like the Great Depression happen again. And I think it's fair to say that the Fed did do things that helped the financial markets not to get in nearly as bad a shape as they did in the 1930s. That's a pretty low bar. We're just saying, did the Fed stop economic conditions from getting to be as worse as they've ever been in the history of the United States? Okay? And the answer to that is, I think yes. Mike may disagree with me, but I think yes. The main thing that they did, they lowered the Fed funds rate back down again. If you remember in the graph, it had gone up. Right? So after the crisis, they lowered it right back down to 1% or below 1%. The other thing that they did was they just created a tremendous amount of liquidity. A big problem in the crisis was that Wall Street had created these very fancy financial assets that were securitized mortgages or essentially options on securitized mortgages, and they had stopped trading because everybody thought these mortgages were bad. So there's no trading of these assets, there's no being able to get prices for these assets.
They may not have even thought they were bad, they just didn't know what the prices were.
Right. Well, they didn't know what the prices were because fear that there was something bad in it stopped anyone from being willing to buy. It's hard to know what the price is of something if no one will buy it or sell it. Okay, so that market freezes up, there's a great amount of price uncertainty, and essentially the Fed came in and just accepted these questionable loans, or a lot of them, as collateral for lending out safe stuff. And so the Fed took a lot of money onto their balance sheet, they took a lot of questionable assets onto their balance sheet to try to sort of unfreeze the financial system. They also used quantitative easing, which is what Ben Bernanke was talking about in the video when he contradicted himself. Right, the first time was quantitative easing 1 when he said they were printing money. The second time was quantitative easing 2 when he said that they weren't. But they're both the same thing. So they either were or they weren't, and they were. Okay. Quantitative easing differs from traditional open market operations only in that it tries to directly target a longer-term interest rate. Remember we said that open market operations, the Fed uses them to try to control the Fed funds rate, which is a very short-term overnight rate between banks. Well, they've driven that rate down close to 0. And so there's nothing more they can do there. They can't make it negative. So the Fed and quantitative easing, what the Fed does is they buy, rather than buying and selling short-term assets, they buy and sell longer-term assets. 10-year treasury bonds, 20-year treasury bonds, mortgages. In the first round, they were using private debt that they were buying, long-term private debt. In the second round, they were using government debt that they were buying. So quantitative easing was a way to try to drive down longer-term interest rates and things like that. I apologize for the incredible unprofessionalism of what I'm about to do now, but this is in this morning's Wall Street Journal, so I couldn't get it into my presentation. But the lead headline is Fed searches for next step. The program of quantitative easing 2 is set to stop next week. And so
this is after months and months
of doing it. And the question is what to do. This picture here that's very hard to see, I apologize for that. It's the amount of stuff the Fed has bought up, the amount of assets the Fed is holding on its balance sheet. This is before the crisis, and it's about $750 trillion of financial assets the Fed was holding. Quantitative easing 1, right after the bankruptcies and stuff of Lehman Brothers in 2008, shoots up to almost $2 trillion. And now the Fed's balance sheet is somewhere north of about $2.5 trillion of assets that the Fed has bought up. Okay? And again, how do they pay for those assets that they buy? They print money. They pay for those assets by creating electronic credits from on the accounts of the people that they buy them from. They don't literally print dollar bills and hand them to them, but they create electronic money. And there's some concern when the Fed stops buying up, say, $100 billion of U.S. Treasury debt every month, what's going to happen to interest rates and what's going to happen to Treasury borrowing? Because the other thing that's not part of this talk, but the other thing I think that we all know, right, is that our government is borrowing a boatload of money right now. We're running a very big deficit. We're spending a lot of money. We're not paying for a lot of it with taxes. We're running a deficit of over $1 trillion annually right now. I'm so old, I can remember when a billion was a big number. Right. Now a billion doesn't even make your pupils wide or anything like that. The new number is a trillion to get anyone's attention. So, challenges for the Fed. One challenge is going to be, what are they going to do with this almost $3 trillion of assets that they have on their balance sheet? Right. Presumably, economists expect that they will reduce their balance sheet back down to historical levels at some point. Back down to a mere three-quarters of a trillion or $1 trillion or so. That would require them to sell those assets off in the open market, which would essentially be reducing money and credit. Right? They'll sell the assets, people will buy them, they'll get the credit back and just sort of tear it up, extinguish it electronically. So there's a real worry that when the Fed, the finance term for selling this stuff off is unwinding, when the Fed unwinds their position, start selling off all these extra assets that they've bought, that will cause credit to tighten, interest rates to rise, and hurt economic performance. So how does the Fed get out of all the easing that they've done is a challenge for them. Another challenge for them is, now that we know there could be a financial crisis like this, could happen again, that the Great Moderation isn't the rule of the land and we haven't solved all our economic problems, we have to take seriously this idea that there's a zero bound on interest rates. In 2007 and 2008, the Taylor rule predicted the optimal interest rate to be a negative number. Right? And policymakers can't do that, right? The Fed can't set the interest rate at minus 3%. That would say that the government's going to come and charge you. If you have $100, the government's going to come in every year and take $3 away from you. Right? We don't do that. So we can't have a negative interest rate. Oops, sorry. So how to conduct monetary policy when interest rates have this zero bound, and sometimes we want to do something else, and we're constrained by our instrument hitting the floor. One possibility that's being suggested in this context is, rather than targeting interest rates, that the Federal Reserve should directly target inflation. And that they should target inflation at something around 3% or something like that. So inflation targeting is one policy proposal to get around this now perceived weakness of interest rate targeting, that interest rates have a floor that they can't go below. Some people have suggested, rather than targeting the inflation rate, that you should target the path of the price level. The inflation rate is just the first difference of the price level. Other people have suggested it would be better to target the price level itself, or a path to the price level. Another challenge for the Fed is whether or not they should amend their policy, the things that they look at when they set monetary policy, to include trying to fight against or prevent or burst asset bubbles. Should the Fed have taken into account, when they set their monetary policy, should they have taken into account the fact that housing prices were rising at 10 to 15% a year, that housing prices were way above any sort of historical norms for those prices, right? Should they have seen that, taken that into account, tightened up policy to try to slow down the rate of increase of housing prices, or get them to level off, or even get them to fall gently rather than drop off the cliff like they did now? So this is a huge debate in monetary policy about, should the Fed, instead of just looking at the overall inflation rate and the unemployment rate or the output gap, should they look at financial market conditions? Should they target and try to fight against bubbles? The obvious answer to that would be yes, right? The crisis that we went through was horrible. It bankrupted a lot of people. It caused a lot of economic distress globally. And we still, 3.5 years later, haven't recovered from it. Right, unemployment in the United States now is still in the high eights, like 8.9 or 8.8% currently. Or we'd think a normal unemployment rate might be more like 5.5%. So we have a very, very long way to go to get back to normal in this country. So having prevented the housing crash would have been a very good thing. But again, I don't know how many of you guys followed this. If you look back at what was going on at the time, the chairman of the Fed at the beginning of this, Alan Greenspan, said, no, that's not a bubble. Right, there's no asset bubble here. This is good. You know, we're expanding housing opportunities. Prices are going up. America's doing great. He said something like, it wasn't just bubbles. It wasn't a bubble. There might just be a little froth in the market, he very famously said, but no bubble. So it's hard to know what is an asset bubble or what isn't a bubble, what's a good investment and what's unsustainable, until afterwards. Once it bursts, then you're like, oh, geez, that was a bubble. Right? So it's difficult to say in advance what is an asset bubble, and the Fed surely doesn't want, when Congress is encouraging people, wants there to be affordable housing, is encouraging subprime lending, is putting pressure on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to increase mortgage opportunities for less qualified buyers and things like that. The last thing the Fed can afford to do politically, really, is to say, oh no, we don't like this, we're going to raise interest rates and try to reduce this increase in housing. So theoretically, if we could identify bubbles in advance, reliably, and if Congress would let them do it, then adding asset prices to the things that the Fed officially looks at might be a good idea. But that's way more difficult than it sounds. That's pretty much what I wanted to talk about in terms of challenges for the Fed. And we're pretty much out of time, so I'd be happy to take any questions or comments. Or yes, please.
This seems a lot like what I heard central planning is like for other economic systems, where there's a group of people who sit around and decide the price of something. Why do they allow that when we talk about that being a bad thing?
Okay, so central planning would be like if we had a Fed for every price, right? Here we have a Fed essentially for the price of money. You could think of it as the interest rate. If we had another organization that was setting like the price of oil, another one setting the price of steel, and then we pretty much would have central planning. Yeah. There are a lot of conservative economists that argue we don't need money to be run by the government, that money could be treated as a private commodity like we treat other commodities. The argument, I think, is that money in some sense is a public good. And we typically use the government to provide goods that are called public goods. The traditional definition of a public good is something that if I consume it, I don't reduce the total amount of it, that how much as I consume, Mike can still consume it, like national defense, right? The missile that protects me protects Mike just as much. Sure. And that you can't exclude people from using it. Okay? Even if I don't pay any taxes, those missiles still protect me. Okay? So money's not a classic public good in that regard, right? Because obviously if I spend money, there's that much less for Mike to spend, and I can definitely be excluded from using money, right? If I don't have a job and I don't get any money, that's bad for me. But that's the argument that most people would use, that money has this, that there's this public nature of money, so that if there's a monetary crash, that produces negative effects for a lot of other people that weren't involved in causing the crash.
Because confidence in the monetary system might be a public good.
Right. Sure. I think that's a better way to think of it. Thank you. So we do see the government intervening and either trying to regulate or trying to directly produce things that have this sort of public aspect to them. And that would be the argument. But there are a fair amount of economists who would argue that money could be just treated as a private commodity, that private firms could issue their own money, that reputation or insurance would be sufficient to allow that money to be exchanged and traded. And that's an alternative. The guy, Ron Paul, who I've skipped over here in the interest of time, has argued that the U.S. should go back on the gold standard, abolish the Fed, and go back on the gold standard. This is his argument. He got what in the last election, Mike?
Beaten.
3%? Beaten, yes. But like 2%, 3%?
In a couple of primaries, he got 8% after everybody else left. Mm-hmm. But there is a substantial 5%, maybe a little more, of the U.S. population that would very much want to get rid of the Fed.
Yeah, I think that's
And that's their issue. It's a single issue. Voters like abortion, or that's their issue.
Other questions or comments?
Well, we need to wrap up. You guys can ask questions privately. Forgive me, because I know people have to go.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Professor.